Welcome to the Dealmaker Uncut podcast, where we speak to some of the UK's most exciting entrepreneurs and hear their investment journeys. We'll discuss the challenges, successes, and lessons they've learned along the way with expert deals commentary from Jonathan Boyers, head of Alvarez & Marsal Corporate Finance, and me, Chris Maguire, executive editor at Business Cloud. Welcome everyone to the latest episode of the Dealmaker Uncut podcast, powered by Alvarez & Marsal. My name, as always, is Chris Maguire, executive editor of Business Cloud, and it's good to be back alongside multiple award-winning dealmaker himself, Jonathan Boyers. Jonathan's been involved in deals totaling £5 billion during his long and illustrious career, and he's a managing director and head of Alvarez & Marsal's corporate finance practice in the UK. Welcome, Jonathan. You're looking great.
Thanks, Chris. Delighted to be back doing the podcast.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We've got to keep our dear listeners happy. Now, before we introduce our guest, a quick shout out to What Media, who produce the Dealmaker Uncut podcast. They're the kings of video creation, and we're delighted to be working with them. In the first part of today's show, we're going to be interviewing our special guest. You're going to say who that is in a second. After that, we'll have a little break. We'll give our reflections on the interview before you, Jonathan, lean onto your 35 years of working in corporate finance to answer some listener questions. So let's put our listeners and the viewers out of their misery. Who are we speaking to today?
Well, today I'm really pleased to be speaking to Matthew Scullion. So Matthew is the award-winning CEO of the Manchester-based tech unicorn Matillion. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here. Looking forward to the conversation.
Matthew, I'm going to kick off with a couple of easy questions before Jonathan goes into the real deal-making stuff. So you founded Matillion in 2011 with your co-founder, Ed Thompson. You now employ 500 people in Manchester and Denver, and more recently Hyderabad in India. You've got a turnover approaching about 100 million US. So in very, very simple terms, just explain what Matillion does.
Happy to. So Matillion's a software company. We manufacture a platform of software technology products, and our mission is to eliminate friction in the way businesses use data. Long story short, the world and industry and most organizations are awash with data, but the challenge is making that data business ready and useful to derive insight from it and power AI. I think you, Chris, at least have heard me say before, it's a little like refining steel from iron ore. We have lots of iron ore in the world, but before you can do interesting things with it, you have to refine it into steel. And we make software technology that does that refinement process, but for data.
Great. I meet lots of business owners, lots of CEOs as well. And, you know, there's a difference between the businesses that are doing okay and the ones that fly. And in the world of tech, it tends to be the ones who create their own software. So your business founded in 2011, doing quite nicely, thanks very much. 2014-15, you decided to make your own software. That was the pivot. That was the game changer. So just explain that decision and what difference it made to Matillion, the company.
Well, I think you're right that organizations can scale faster and larger and more cost effectively when the unit economics support that. And a software company, the marginal cost of an extra person using your software is normally very low, and the geographic barriers to selling an extra customer or user or consumption unit of your software are also very low. And that means that you can grow very quickly and capital efficiently and grow globally. And so that's why software companies or other technology-centered companies with SaaS-like unit economics can grow very quickly. And I think this is actually something that's worth reflecting on, as we think about our society, because we talk a lot about tech. And normally when a tech scene is emerging, we're kind of desperate to attach that label to almost anything. Garden center with a website, you know, garden tech. But the thing that makes technology companies able to get large and valuable quickly is those unit economics. And if you look at the difference between economic growth, like zooming right to the other end of the spectrum in the US versus the UK over the last 15 to 20 years, the gap is really tech companies. The quality of life and the personal disposable income of every American citizen has gone up more than ours here in the UK, the gap is mostly tech, and it's because of those scalable unit economics. So bringing that back to Matillion, you're absolutely right, Chris. We started off as a solutions company, really. So we had to do work every time we sold a new customer deal. But we were on the right sports field, I think. We knew we wanted to be at the intersection of two technology megatrends, cloud and data. And those were true on the first day of Matillion in 2011. They're true today. We'd put ourselves in the right kind of sports field, but we weren't yet an ISV, an independent software vendor, a company whom once you've built the software, you can sell that marginal unit of it anywhere in the world and very cost effectively, which is what allows you to get very big.
Great. Interesting. So can we just talk about raising investment?
Yeah.
In 2021, you raised $150 million through a Series E funding raise, which was led by General Atlantic. Now, I think that took the total amount that you've raised up to $310 million. And there was a valuation placed on the business then at $1.5 billion. So now I think that was about, that must have been the seventh raise, was it, that you'd done? But you know, you'd done a series of raises. And obviously you now have a share register, as I can see, that is a who's who of technology investors. I'd be really interested to hear this, your reflections on the not just that last fundraising, but on the various fundraisings before, and the things that you encountered along the way. Because a lot of people will be looking at earlier stage fundraising than that, and they'll look at you and think, "Gosh, that is the dream outcome, to end up in a position that, you've not finished yet, but end up where you are." And it would just be good if you could just talk about that.
More than happy to. And thanks for asking the question, Jonathan. I'll start at the end if you want, because I agree with you that a lot of people would say that's the dream outcome. And I would immediately say to them that is completely wrong. It's not an outcome at all. It's purely a fuel to drive the growth in your business. And I sort of make that point a little bit passionately, because
I did catch myself actually.
Capital serves entrepreneurialism, not the other way around. The idea isn't to raise money. You raise money to fuel the idea. But I think your way of describing it is entirely understandable, because that is what everybody says. They're like, oh, I want to be a unicorn. I want to raise capital. But no, those things are byproducts and they're fuel. They're things you can do once you've created sufficient momentum and value. And they're things that you do in order to create more momentum and value. So always like to be super clear on that point. Also, I think it's very common with all of us, isn't it? Maybe we're looking at an athlete or a sports team or a business. We see the beginning dot on the curve and the end dot on the curve, and we assume the line between the two is straight, and it isn't. There's lots of ups and downs. You know, the overnight success of Matillion that so far has only taken 14 years. We've had five major institutional fundraising rounds, Series A, B, C, D, and E, I suppose. A couple of strategic investments, although those are more for business synergy reasons. And of course, it all got started with where it so often does with business building, with the so-called friends and family or angel rounds. But we've also had occasions on the way where we've thought about raising money and decided that we weren't able to because we didn't have the numbers or progress. There's been times along the way when we thought we were able to and then didn't get it away. So there's lots of oscillations on that journey. Mm. In summary, Jonathan, when we started the business off in 2011, and Chris kindly name checked my co-founder, Ed Thompson. There's actually two co-founders of Matillion. There's myself, Ed, and a gentleman called Peter McCord. Peter is not even my particular friend, but I'd been my boss in a previous company, and he had two business partners, Vicky and Simon, and now sadly late Simon. But I approached those three people, and they'd spent a number of years working with me. I showed them a business plan they told me years later, we didn't really believe the business plan, but we thought you might make something of it. And they invested the seed capital, if you like, the seed round. That was into that Gen 1 business, that solutions business. And that was, if memory serves, about £750,000. So I suppose about $1 million, although it was chunked. So it didn't all turn up on the first day. Also, we weren't a software business on the first day, so the capital profile is different. It took us about 6 months of that initial business to have something that was ready to sell. And I think we got our first revenue on kind of month 7 or 8. So that's what I was trying to fund. But yeah, £750,000 sterling, kind of in the friends and family or angel stage. And then our first institutional round came after launching our software product. And we could see that we were racing towards getting some strong product market fit. We could feel that kind of sensation of the market trying to tear our products out of our hands. We'd launched our software product, Matillion ETL, as it was then, in October of 2015. And by the time we were trying to raise money in the late spring of 2016, we could already see the revenue profile was about 2/3 US-based, about 1/3 non-US. So we thought, gosh, we're probably going to need to go to the US, and that's going to cost some money. So started to get busy raising some capital. Had a small crack at doing that in Silicon Valley. Looking back on that, I didn't know what I was doing there. In retrospect, I think I probably could have got that away, but I didn't really know what I was doing. Came back to the UK, hired a small boutique corporate finance advisor who introduced me to a bunch of VCTs, and in retrospect was lucky to partner with the guys at YFM, who did our Series A round, if you like. And then after that, we were up and running and started to get a bit of profile. And all of our other rounds, as you nicely sort of mentioned, have been with fairly blue chip kind of Sandhill Road investors. Sandhill Road is the street in Menlo Park, Silicon Valley, where all the tech VCs are based. And so I think all my other investors since that moment have probably got an office there. So that's why I mentioned that.
Really, really interesting. One thing that I've been talking to a few people about recently, who there's one particular business I've been talking to, a fast-growing technology business who's got venture capital on board and is debating the next step and whether that should be seek a partnership or a strategic investor as opposed to either a private equity investor or an outright sale. And I'm just, it would be good if you could just talk about the decision to take on strategic investors and the advantages and the considerations of that.
Yeah, definitely. So I guess the ultimate product behind investment is homogeneous, right? It's a dollar, and those are the same no matter where you get them from. So you also have to consider what else you get, puts and takes, when you take money from someone, or if it's raising money through equity, when you sell part of your business to someone to raise money. I always think it's worth clearly thinking through that language as you do it, and that's what you're doing. You're selling a slice of your business to someone else and using the money to fuel future growth. A lot of the time, that will be a financial investor. So their thesis is ultimately simple. They've taken money from someone else on the promise that they're going to give back more. They're going to make the best possible decision they can make to use that money they've been given to buy a slice of a company that they think is going to go up in value. So when they say no to you, I always think it's worthwhile remembering that. They're the custodians of other people's money. They've promised to make that money worth more, and they're making a judgment on whether they think you will make them more money or not. So most investment is in one way or another financial investment, and in one way or another it's a variation on that theme. Strategic investment is different because it's raison d'etre. The thing at the heart of it isn't necessarily about making a financial return for the investor. It's more about fueling a strategic advantage, a partnership. So Making up an example, if I was a large car company and there was an up-and-coming in-car technology firm, I, as the car company, might choose to invest in that firm because it will make it easier for us to partner. And it's also worth remembering, because once I've invested, I get some shareholder rights that allow me to see a quarterly earnings report and probably give me some privileges to buy the company before anybody else if they want to. So as that big car company, it might be quite useful to know what's going on at this little technology company and to have to always be at the front of the queue to buy them if that ever becomes useful to you. For the little company, of course, it's really useful to say, hey, Ford or Mercedes or BMW is an investor, makes them sound really good. And it probably makes it much easier to go and talk to the appropriate customer in whoever it was that invested them, you know, Ford or Mercedes, whatever, to go and talk to them. And so that's what underpins strategic investment. It's the ability to get business done. The big guy does it to build his or her ecosystem and to get insight and the ability to partner more resonantly or acquire the up-and-coming technology firm. So it's kind of like a version of R&D. And the little guy normally does it for their brand prestige and the ability to partner with that bigger company. So I have three strategic investors. One of them is a company called Snowflake. And it just so happens, the majority of my customers are also Snowflake customers. So it makes real sense for us to hang out together and have that intimate partnership. The second one is a company called Databricks. Exactly the same. My non-Snowflake customers are mostly Databricks customers. And then the third one for me is actually a bank. It's the bank Citi. In the kind of prior pre-cloud generation of the sort of technology that we build, Citi were the biggest customer of my competitor and of the second place competitor and of the third place competitor all at the same time. So they were the world's biggest customer for what I do. And therefore, it seemed to make sense to strategically partner. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So very often going through that, any funding round, there's normally an impact on the control that a CEO will have on the business. Investors want to introduce various checks and balances and controls. It would be good to know, I sense that you've retained a large degree of independence in your business despite having several different venture capital, private equity and strategics. Could you just talk about how you've managed to negotiate your way through keeping control of the business through all those fundraisers?
I can't really talk about the boardroom dynamics.
Of course,
I can talk about the concept.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're absolutely right. Every new investment round, really what's happening, and I think, again, for the purpose of the podcast, it's just worth talking about the core physics of what happens with investment. Ultimately, you tend to be raising capital because you want to invest in something in your own business. Maybe you want to hire some software engineers to build some product. You hire the engineers and start paying them straight away. It takes a while to build the product. Then it takes a while to sell it, then you start getting the revenue back. So you need capital to cover that gap. That might be a reason why you're raising capital. Same for a sales team. You know, you don't hire the sales guy on the first day and he closes a deal, alas. So if you're growing fast and building out a go-to-market team, you need capital to cover that. So if you're doing an equity raise, as I know you know, Jonathan, what you're doing is you are selling part of the company to raise that capital so you can go and buy those salespeople or buy those software engineers. And the reason I just wanted to be clear about that is that sale event of part of your company, the person that buys it, the investor, they tend to get their own terms as they get ownership of your bit of your company. So Series A, Series B, Series C, they tend to be the smaller round, then the slightly larger round, then the slightly larger round. But behind the scenes, they're actually a class of shares. And it's basically saying, hey, you've bought 10% of my company. And to say thank you for that, so as part of the deal, you get some particular privileges. And some of them might be tied to your 10% of ownership, or some of them might be special privileges that kind of trump everybody else. And so by the time you got to Series E, you've got a bunch of people that own those so-called preferred shares. Mm. And the sort of things that are in the preferred shares are, well, first of all, you get the right to a board seat. So if you own some shares, you get to join the board. And most CEOs of venture-backed businesses can be fired by their board. In fact, I would argue that is one of the principal roles of the board. It's at the end of every board meeting to decide whether to retain or fire me. And so that's one of the things that you're kind of buying the right to do, I suppose. Other ones would be deciding to sell the company. So there are 11 people on my board. Some of them are independents. A couple of them are founders and executives, myself and one other seat in that role. The others are investors. If a gigantic software company X or Y knocked on the door and said, how about we call it X billion dollars, Matthew? I might not want to sell, but I have a fiduciary duty to tell my board. And my board goes, that sounds great. And so the board can make that decision. So yeah, the physics of control are really interesting, I think. And it's why the most important thing to consider when you're raising capital is who you are partnering with and do you share the same vision?
I'm really pleased you said that. I think a lot of the time when we're talking to people, they look at the financial dynamics of a deal. Whereas in reality, often the most important thing is, who have you done it with somebody that's aligned, that you can work with?
Yeah.
Interpersonally, you can get on with, and corporately, that you're aligned.
100%.
And yeah.
I think price of capital is third on my list of things I consider.
It's fascinating. When Jonathan gets into deals and he finds somebody, a like-minded person, I feel like I should walk out of the room and just leave you to it because, you know, you really bring stuff to life. We've sort of spoke about unicorns and becoming a unicorn, and to be honest with you, it's not big on your priority list. And I think people, media especially, are too quick to talk about being unicorns.
It's catchy, isn't it?
It's catchy. It's catchy. And Jonathan always says, oh, Chris, you always mention unicorns like that. And there are fewer unicorns in the UK, but there are fewer unicorns globally at the moment as well. I want to talk about investment. I've said before that I think you're really good at explaining things. You talk in a language that people understand. And in the media, we quite often talk about people complaining about their inability to raise investment. You've just touched upon, you know, with Jonathan, how much money that you've raised. And you used a really good analogy and you said it's a bit like somebody who doesn't get onto an Olympic running team and they turn around and they say, this is outrageous, I can't get onto this Olympic running team. And they say, but Chris, you run 100 metres in, you know, 23 seconds, that's why. It's the same with investment. If you can't raise investment, don't blame the investor, make yourself more investable. And you talk about this British disease where we instantly complain. Just tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I think that's right. If I could just, Chris, before I launch into that, the unicorn point, you are right, a lot less unicorns have been created in the UK in the last 12, 24 months. I always think it's worth remembering, it's almost another part of the British disease. We beat ourselves up, don't we? A lot less unicorns have been created globally. And I think the UK is still number three in the world after China and the US for unicorn creation. So part of the British disease that I sometimes think we've got, and we've got a lot of strengths as well, but part of it is just our natural nature of beating ourselves up. And it's what makes us good at making comedy, I suppose, but it's not great for entrepreneurialism. And yeah, everyone's been creating less unicorns, as you pointed out. The blaming everybody else thing, I mean, I'm sure we see this phenomenon in other aspects of human life, don't we? But it does seem to be a thing, I think at least, when we chat in early stage entrepreneurialism in the UK and around where I live in Manchester, founders, sometimes even proto-founders or early stage management teams kind of being frustrated that they can't raise capital. Often, sometimes that is tied to geography as well. There is no venture capital in, you know, West Altrincham. So that's where I'm based. So I can't raise capital. I think there's always a risk that we can blame other people. A guy from Goldman Sachs once said to me, I thought brilliantly, he said, where you IPO is really important. But if you're Stripe, you can IPO in Timbuktu and investors will turn up to your earnings call. And what it means by that is if your company's good enough, the investor will get on the phone or get on Zoom or get in the car or get on a plane to come to see you. And it's all the same kind of axis of conversation. I think it's just, you know, the perception versus the reality. We are often preoccupied at venture capital or valuation as the goal. And it's absolutely not. It's just the side effect and the fuel. And we often worry about the availability of capital rather than worrying about building an amazing business. If you've got the amazing business, the capital will take care of itself. And I'll speak from experience here. This isn't sort of, well, we did it, so everybody else is all right. I've tried to do plenty of fundraising rounds that I've not gone away. Mm-hmm. And it's because we weren't good enough. We came back to the office and we got better and then we tried again and then we got them away. So that's what I mean.
I heard a good story about Steven Gerrard, you know, the Liverpool captain, former Liverpool captain, England legend. And he was recognised as being probably the best midfielder of his generation. And what was the reason for his success? And they were talking about the wealth that has come along with that. And he never spoke about the money. He always said, I want to be the best footballer I can be. I want to be, I want to be the captain, you know, the team, the person in which Liverpool is built around. And the money and the riches and the wealth and the fame that came with it was a byproduct of his success as a footballer. And they were using that as an example of footballers who want to be millionaires. They want to drive fast cars. They want to have, you know, the trappings of wealth. But they lose sight of the fact they want to be the best footballer. And I look at your story about what you want to do at Matillion. You don't want to raise money. You want Matillion to be a business that's going to change the world. And the investment and the rewards are a byproduct of that. Is that a fair analogy?
Yeah, but apart from you almost paint it like that's a choice. But raising money doesn't make any difference to the wealth of the entrepreneur, right? And it's like saying, do you want to buy inventory or do you want to be successful? Like when I say it's a fuel, that's not an opinion. Like it's actually just a fuel that you go off and spend on staff or marketing or premises. But I think the fundamental part of your observation there, Chris, is absolutely bang on. And it is the case that you speak to founders and CEOs and entrepreneurs across the spectrum, actually. And it's reasonably common that their goal is an outcome-style goal. The word exit is used a lot. The word unicorn is used a lot. The word raise capital or phrase raise capital is used a lot. For me, at least, the outcome has to be something that's not a measure of finance. You set up a business, I think, to change the world in a small way, to make planet Earth just spin on its axis slightly different and slightly better, and in doing so be proud that you've built something beautiful and that you've made a dent in the universe bigger than yourself. That's what Steven Gerrard, I guess, was talking about with his football, and I think that's what drives entrepreneurs and founders. And the other stuff is a fuel and a byproduct. That's something that I think really helps to keep in mind as you think about your business building journey.
So you mentioned earlier that, you know, what might happen if somebody came along and put an enormous price tag on the business and wanted to buy it. When you look at your vision for the business, does it include a sale of the business at some point? Or I'm just interested in there's always the possibility that could happen, and I wonder what your view of that and how often people around the board think about it. So some companies think about it all the time as the objective, as you say, but
British companies think about it all the time. This is a night and day difference. Really lucky as I've kind of been on my journey over the last few years, which I hope we're still just in the first few laps of. To, of course, meet a bunch of other CEOs in Manchester, where we're headquartered and I live, across the UK and across the US. Now, I'll say this next thing like it's a universal and universally accurate rule. It's not. There's plenty of exceptions that prove the rule both ways. But in general, I only ever hear the word exit in the UK. I don't hear it in the US at all. Founders and CEOs in tech that I happen to know just don't talk about exits. We talk about whatever the thing is we're doing. And not least because, you know, once you've got other people on your board with aligned intentions in the short to medium term, but ultimately those other people need a financial return, there's almost no point worrying about it because you're not fully in control of it anyway. And that was the point I was making earlier with share classes and board members. Yeah. I think if a founder CEO says to his or her board, I'd like to sell, they probably do have some agency in that because, you know, in a sub 100, maybe even a sub 500 million revenue company, boards, I think to an extent rightly, attribute a lot of the potential success of that company to the founder or the founding team. And so if that person wants to sell, they're either tired or they can see something that the board can't. Mm. And in either of those cases, that's probably a decent signal to investor board members to say, okay, Jonathan, you know, if you think it's a good idea to sell, we should probably cash our chips in now. But going the other way, if the founder wants to keep going, and as they often do, then the sale event is not going to be his or her decision. It's going to be a board saying, we want to cash our chips in now. And the key thing to remember about that is if you've got a high conviction that the asset that you're holding is going to be worth twice as much in 12 months' time, you don't sell it. And so what normally triggers sales is when people think the valuation curve is dropping off. Here in the UK, we talk about exits all the time. It's normally a question I'm asked within 30 seconds of telling people I'm an entrepreneur. You guys have done very well. I admire your restraint. I would say, and you know, this is a bit of a punchy Matthew sort of thing to say, I would say that's why there are no very big businesses created here, because we all spend our time talking about exits. It's impossible to build something big if you stop before you've done it.
Interesting.
Mindful of time, what we do, we discuss beforehand, we put some questions on, and then the conversation takes us where the conversation takes us. Have you got any questions you want to ask Matthew before we move on?
The one question that just occurred to me when you were talking, so the business has now got a big presence in the US as well, and you talked about the different dynamics, you know, people saying different things from the US to the UK. There's a lot happening in the US at the moment. I was just wondering what your reflections on the whole doing business in the US and
yeah
would be.
I mean, quickly I'll say, I think before we sort of dive onto the the Donald and all that sort of thing, I think we have so much latent opportunity here in Blighty, in Manchester and across the country, because there's nothing magical in the US in terms of how the raw materials used to build business. We have a lot of capital in the UK. We have a lot of skills in the UK, comms infrastructure, legal system. We all speak English. People generally speaking like us. It's just attitude and playbook is the difference, which is kind of the point I'm trying to make earlier. But to the thrust of your question, Jonathan, are things changing? I mean, the US is just an enormous domestic market. And I don't personally see that changing anytime soon. Obviously, if it catches a cold, then that makes life harder for people selling into it. And if it's on a tear, that makes things easier for people selling into it. But most software companies will have 60 to 80% of their revenue just in the US. I always think about Salesforce here. Mm. For those of us that spend any time in London, you know that Salesforce have quite a shiny, quite a tall building in the middle of London. And it makes you think that London must be a massive market for Salesforce. And I'm sure it is. the entire rest of the world for Salesforce is only 40% of their revenue. Like 60% of their revenue is still just in the US. It's just an enormous market. So in general, if you want to build a big business, you probably need to be selling into the US market and doing that effectively. Where there is, I think, and we're seeing a little bit, an amazing opportunity for UK-based businesses is one friction that I'll definitely admit is real. It's not kind of a perception one and a one we choose to make. It's a real one is, of course, so many technology businesses have been built in the West Coast of the US that there's a lot of skills there. And software engineering skills, we're fantastic here. Creative digital media skills, we're fantastic here. But if you need like just someone that's built a scaled SaaS platform that 100,000 users have used and done it twice, it's just hard to find that outside of the Bay Area. You know, if you need a deep, reinforcement learning ML ops guy to help you with your large language model training, you may find that in academia here, but it's going to be easier to find in the Bay Area. So one thing that I do think there's an opportunity at our, particularly in academia, I think the international transfer window is open for the world's best professors to come and work at British universities. And I think some of that is maybe starting to happen. I'm really excited about that. We've certainly seen in my company, like amazing US-based executives, not necessarily people that have been in the US their entire lives, but of course, if you walk around Silicon Valley, you realize not many people are actually from there. They've gone there to work. And maybe those people, again, we can get them in the international transfer window to work in our UK-based businesses because people quite like that contrast of where our two countries are up to and our world outlooks, particularly on things like education. So yeah, that's what I'm excited about. But I don't think, we're suddenly going to, speaking personally for Matillion, just in case any of my team or board members are listening, I can definitely confirm that we won't be deprioritizing the US. But I would also advise anyone listening to the podcast that the US market for technology companies is 60 to 80% of your revenue. And I don't think that'll change anytime soon.
Really interesting, Matthew. I could listen to you all day, and it's your insights. And so appreciative of your time, because I know how busy you are. What's going to happen now? We're going to have a short break, and then afterwards, myself and Jonathan will reflect on that interview. And, if your board members are listening, we will decide, or Jonathan will decide, whether or not we like you or not.
Like Dragon's Den.
Absolutely, like yeah. Dragon's Den. Okay, thanks very much. So welcome back to the second half of the Dealmaker Uncut podcast. We've just interviewed Matthew Scullion, CEO of Matillion. What do you think of him, Jonathan?
Well, what a great guy. I suppose the thing that I notice most is just his focus, as he articulated a few times, his focus on developing the business. And he talked about the sort of investment and the corporate finance aspects of what he's achieved, which is quite remarkable. But all that has been done effectively to fuel and the vision that he's striving towards, and I just think that came through really strongly, as well as a strong view about the way that the UK could probably drive emerging businesses faster and harder and maybe longer. So I think those two points came out to me really powerfully.
There's a standing joke at Business Cloud Towers. If somebody wants to offer us £10 million, I'll sell it. And incidentally, if anyone's listening who wants to buy Business Cloud £10 million, we would sell it, myself and Jonathan. But the point he makes is that we spend so much time in this country talking about exits, and ultimately, a lot of your work is around exits as well. Mm-hmm. But I think when you get somebody like Matthew and becoming a unicorn, there's no navel gazing with Matthew. He doesn't see it as, well, look at me, I'm a unicorn, I'm really rich, I'm this, I'm that. He's got this passion at the age of 46, which he's always had, that he's only just got started. And look, you know the US market far better than I, but that sort of makes him almost more American in his as a tech entrepreneur than probably his UK counterparts. Would that be fair?
Well, he seemed to be very, very pro the UK emerging business community as well, though. So I just thought that was a great, really illuminating conversation.
Mm. So this final part of the show, Jonathan, is a bit that we call Ask Jonathan, the clues in the name, where listeners or myself ask you any question they want. The question I would ask for our viewers on YouTube is, where do you get that shirt from? That shirt's fantastic.
I've had it quite some time, but it's only just fitting me. I can only just fit into it.
Absolutely.
Well, lost a bit of weight.
Absolutely. You're looking fantastic in that shirt. So first question is actually from me. I looked at a LinkedIn post that you did recently, and you described the M&A market as a bit of a curate's egg at the moment. So in your opinion, Jonathan, which sectors are hot to trot and which ones are not?
Okay, yeah. So I did say that, and I was just trying to refer, in a lot of ways, There's lots of people interested in selling their businesses, and there's still lots of private equity money and corporate acquirers interested in acquiring. So there's a lot of dynamics to drive deals in the market. They are taking a bit longer to get over the line sometimes, and often you need to lean into issues to solve them to get deals done. So some sectors are harder and take longer to get deals done. You know, things like consumer sentiment can often be a factor that holds businesses back. But there are other sectors that are absolutely flying. The legal services sector is red hot from an M&A point of view at the moment. We've just completed something in technical services into the built environment, which you wouldn't necessarily have said would be a hot sector, but you know that was sold in. We ran a very quick process and achieved a great outcome on that. And we're seeing that sector is also really really strong. But you know, there's some of the traditional services, tech enabled services, software, parts of healthcare. You'll always guarantee that you'll get a really well attended auction. So it's just, if you've got a great business that's growing rapidly in one of these sectors, then you will be able to get a great outcome from a sale process. Even though there's some of the other sectors just take a bit harder to get them over the line, but deals are still getting done across the board.
Next question: we've got listeners for the Dealmaker on a Cut podcast all over the world, including in Denmark, very big in Denmark. And this question is, I'm the founder of a business and I need to raise investment, but how do I avoid giving up too much control to the investors? Which I thought was interesting because you touched on that with Matthew earlier.
Yeah, we did talk about it and I did make the point then. Earlier stage funding, often the controls that that investors will require can be a bit lighter touch. Once we're moving into the larger private equity style investment, then the private equity investors do typically want a reasonable amount of control over certain key strategic issues. And that those areas are negotiable and important to understand. And so we made the point when we were talking to Matthew that often the financial deal that an investor is offering can be compared to, you could get three or four offers and you can compare the financial offers. But often the devil is in the detail around the control provisions that what would happen if things go wrong, what rights the investor has to step in or to influence certain decisions. And I would encourage investors to look really closely at those areas, that aspect of the deal as well.
And the final question for this episode of the Dealmaker Uncut is that I've heard that pitch index can make or break a pitch. What's your advice when it comes to putting together a pitch index, and how should I use them in a pitch?
So producing the sales material is important. It's an important part of any fundraising or sales process. The name of the game is often to be really clear about the opportunities in the business and to present the financial information strongly, but without getting carried away. There's no point putting hockey stick projections out into the market that are not realistic. If the business is going to grow really rapidly, be able to demonstrate why, precisely why. And the point we made earlier about having unit metrics, unit economics that support the business plan and the story that's being told. is increasingly important. People want to check on a granular basis what's behind the plan. But then often a pitch deck on its own doesn't really work on its own. So getting face to face with buyers or investors at an early stage, so relationships can be built often in advance of a full sale process. I think that's as important. I think the relationship and the creation of trust and an understanding between counterparties in a deal is probably more important than, you know, what's in the pitch document or in the information memorandum.
Yeah, as always, listen, that sort of advice would cost lots of money and you get it for free by listening to the podcast. Massive thanks to you today. Massive thanks to our guest, Matthew Scullion at Matillion as well. Feel free to send any questions you want to ask Jonathan via the show notes as well. That's all for this episode of the Dealmaker Uncut podcast, powered by Alvarez and Marcel. Final shout out to What Media and the star of the show, Jonathan Boyers.
Thanks, Chris.
And don't forget, if you want to subscribe to the podcast, please do. Tell your friends and family, follow us on social media. And until the next time, goodbye from me, Chris Maguire. Thank you for tuning in to the Dealmaker Uncut podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation and found it insightful. If you like what you heard, be sure to subscribe and tell your friends. We'll catch you in the next episode of the Dealmaker Uncut podcast.